You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, and KFCF 88.1 in Fresno.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 29th, 2015. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. On today's show, two animal rights activists from Oakland are now facing up to 10 years in federal prison for vandalizing fur businesses and releasing captive mink. Their charge? Conspiracy to violate the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. We'll have a debate on that law and how it's being used. Plus, the backlash over Kate Steinle's killing has some counties opting back into collaboration with immigration officials. We'll talk to Alameda County Sheriff Gregory Ahern about why he's doing it, and to an immigrants' rights attorney about why she thinks that's a bad thing. That and more next this hour, after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. Secretary of State John Kerry and other top administration officials are on Capitol Hill again today to try to convince lawmakers to support the Iran nuclear deal. Congress has begun a 60-day review of the international agreement with a vote expected in September. The Senate Armed Services Committee, led by Republican John McCain, is holding today's hearing.
What we want to know, among other things, is how this agreement will affect regional security, proliferation, and the balance of power in the Middle East, what impact it may have on Iran's malign activities and hegemonic ambitions in the region.
McCain has long had Iran in his crosshairs, even joking during his 2008 presidential campaign about bombing Iran. Turkish jets launched their heaviest assault on Kurdish militants in northern Iraq since airstrikes began last week. The overnight strikes came hours after President Tayyip Erdogan said a peace process has become impossible.
I don't think it's possible to continue a peace process with those who take aim at our national security and brotherhood in this country.
Erdogan's remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera. The airstrikes hit Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, targets, including shelters, depots, and caves in six areas. A senior Turkish official said it was the biggest assault since the campaign started. Iraq condemned the airstrikes as a dangerous escalation and an assault on Iraqi sovereignty. Turkey launched near simultaneous strikes against PKK camps in Iraq and Islamic State fighters in Syria last Friday, in what officials called a synchronized fight against terror. The PKK said the strikes are an attempt to crush the Kurdish political movement and create an authoritarian hegemonic system in Turkey. California Governor Jerry Brown's plan to build massive water tunnels through the Bay Delta continues to draw opposition from environmentalists and other activists. The plan is open for comment on a draft environmental impact report, with public meetings yesterday in Sacramento and today in Walnut Grove. Opponents call the plan a boondoggle that would harm endangered species to benefit big agriculture in southern and central California. Christopher Martinez filed this report from Sacramento.
The recently revised plan to build giant water tunnels to divert water around the Bay Delta is open for public comment, and several hundred opponents gathered in Sacramento to voice their concerns. Barbara Berrigan-Padilla is director of the group Restore the Delta.
We are making a video that we're going to polish up and send to Secretary Jewell and to President Obama so that they can hear what the public really thinks about the Bay Delta Conservation Plan.
About 200 people lined up to record their video comments on the sidewalk outside the Sheraton Grand Hotel in Sacramento.
Water is a public trust, and you do not have the right to give it to those who are wealthiest. It is something that belongs to all of us.
A project is just too darn expensive, and there are cheaper alternatives.
Inside the hotel, the State Department of Water Resources was holding the first of two open house meetings about the plan. The $15 billion plan would create a pair of 30-mile-long tunnels to ship water from Northern California to cities and farms in Central and Southern California. Nancy Vogel is with the California Natural Resources Agency.
The hope is that when they get more information, they can write more informed public comments, and that'll help inform what they write to us.
The tunnel plan is a top priority for Governor Jerry Brown. It's been strongly opposed by many environmental groups and Delta farmers and residents. Chief Colleen Sisk is leader of the Winnemem Wintu tribe in the McLeod River area of Northern California. She says the California Fix tunnel plan is the wrong approach.
But the Delta tunnels is not going to address all of the contaminated rivers, all of the springs that you can no longer drink out of. Those are things that we should be thinking about, not how to get more water to GMO farming.
Reporting from the state capitol, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Opponents of California's new vaccine law have been cleared to begin collecting signatures to recall the legislation's author. The California Secretary of State said advocates can begin collecting signatures in Sacramento and Yolo counties for the recall of State Senator Richard Pan. The Sacramento Democrat and pediatrician led the drive this year to make vaccinations mandatory for nearly all California school children. A separate statewide ballot initiative that would invalidate the law also has been cleared to collect signatures. The Los Angeles City Council has voted to ban possession of high-capacity gun magazines in the wake of several deadly mass shootings around the country. It becomes the second major city in the country to do so after San Francisco. The unanimous Los Angeles vote closes a loophole in state law that banned the manufacture and sale of clips holding more than 10 rounds, but not their possession. Julia Leftwich, the legal director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, urged approval of the measure as she spoke to the Los Angeles City Council.
The danger posed to public safety by large capacity magazines is undeniable. Large capacity magazines, some capable of holding more than 100 rounds of ammunition, are the common thread in almost all of our nation's mass shooting. And the idea behind them is to kill large numbers of people quickly and efficiently, and that's exactly what they do.
People who have the magazines will have 60 days from the time the law takes effect to sell, destroy, or take the clips out of Los Angeles. Opponents lined up to denounce the measure.
And it's not the weapon that kills anyone, as brought up by the NRA. It's the idiots that take the weapons to kill stupid people who don't follow directions. So the bottom line is this. Don't say an object is the problem of killing people, because it's not.
Mayor Eric Garcetti says he will sign the measure. Texas authorities have released additional footage from Sandra Bland's 3 days in jail, saying they wanted to dispel rumors she was dead before she got there. Waller County Judge Trey Duhon said reports are circulating on social media, including one that Bland's mugshot was taken after her death.
So we're hoping that by providing this video, that will dispel a lot of these rumors and mistruths that's been perpetuated. And I hope people will understand that when it comes to correct information, social media cannot be relied upon.
Duhon said the rumors have prompted death threats against Waller County officials. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny, hot, breezy in the afternoon, highs in the 80s to lower 90s around the bay, 104 degrees well inland. It is another spare the air day. In Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot, highs 101 to 106 degrees. You can follow us on Twitter at KPFA News. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More news on 94.1 at 7:30.
7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. On Friday, the FBI rolled out what it said was the results of a significant terrorist investigation when it unveiled a grand jury indictment and arrested Joseph Buddenberg and Nicole Kassane. They're being charged with conspiracy to violate the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And here's what they're actually accused of doing: slashing tires of a meat distributor's truck, smashing windows and gluing locks at a furrier, releasing captive mink on fur farms, and several other assorted acts of vandalism. Notably, they are not alleged to have hurt anyone, tried to hurt anyone, or threatened to hurt anyone. But they are facing up to 10 years in prison each and up to $250,000 in fines on top of any restitution that they might be ordered to pay. So, when has the word terrorism been pushed too far? That is the question that we will be taking up this morning. Joining me in studio, I have Ben Rosenfeld. He's an attorney who has defended several animal rights activists charged under this law, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, also on the advisory board of the Civil Liberties Defense Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
And with us on the telephone, we have Patty Strand. She's president of the National Animal Interest Alliance, which lobbied for the passage of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. It was passed in 2006. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
So, Ben Rosenfeld, I want to start with you because you've seen how these cases have actually played out. How does the law get used?
Well, the law gets used in an incredibly chilling way to discourage activism on the part of people who are concerned about the abuse and mistreatment of animals across a wide spectrum of industry and testing and entertainment enterprises. And it contains penalties that ratchet up based purely on economic damage. It was a law that was lobbied for and obtained on behalf of industry. It was drafted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is an industry front group, and it literally subjects activity of a de minimis nature in which no rational person would label terrorism to enhance penalties and the stigma of being branded a terrorist, which does a gross disservice to all of us in a so-called democracy and really cheapens the meaning of the term terrorism and, I think, offends victims of real terror.
Patty Strand, there are already laws against things like vandalism and property destruction. Why does your industry, why does the animal industry need special and specific penalties?
We're not really talking here about vandalism in the sense of like teenagers or young adults going out and just, you know, having a night where they use wire cutters and release animals. This is something that is systematic and strategic, that is done in order to close down legitimate and legal businesses. And I think that everyone, certainly we, would agree that calling it terrorism is too far if it wasn't done in this particular way. If you are an individual who is engaged in one of the targeted industries, which is just basically anything which the animal rights movement, the extremists within the animal rights movement, brand as something that should be eliminated, then you are subject to this kind of continuous intimidation in the pursuit of a political aim. The political aim is to do away with these industries. So it does fit the definition of terrorism.
It actually flatly doesn't. There are few agreed-upon definitions of terrorism. All of them, though, have one thing at their core, which involves injury to people, injury to life. And there's not one documented case of a death or an injury caused by an animal rights person. This, in fact, is the only federal law on the books that we know of that actually sweeps within its ambit of a terrorist definition behavior and activities which don't have to and, for the most part, don't even involve actual threats, let alone ever having involved any harm to a person.
That is what's used
to market the cause, is that they haven't hurt any individuals in the sense that that person's physical being has been violated. But if you own one of these businesses and you've put your life's work into it, you have gotten up every morning early and gone to work, and when you get there, 2 or 3 days out of the week, your locks are glued, your windows have been broken out, you can no longer get any kind of insurance, you do definitely start getting the feeling that somebody is trying to intimidate you into not doing that particular work anymore. And I've worked with scientists who've had gunshots through their windows, not as a result of, not necessarily during the particular protest in front of their house at 2 o'clock in the morning when bullhorns start waking up the neighborhood and the whole neighborhood is scared out of their minds. So the idea that this is just, you know, standard operating procedures as far as legal, lawful, the kind of protest that we all agree should be protected, it's just simply not in that category.
Well, but there's a line, Patty Strand, isn't there, between something being protected and something being charged as terrorism? Property destruction is already illegal. What I can't wrap my head around is if I were to go out into my block and burn down an ice cream parlor, I could be sentenced to less time for arson than if I threw up some graffiti on the pet store next to it under this law.
I don't think so. I think you would have to engage, as these two did, in a systematic set of activities that are aimed at, they're goal is to close down businesses. And this, again, they have gone after over the years, research scientists. Hoses have been, drawn into basements and completely flooded houses so that there's thousands and thousands of dollars of damage. And this goes on. It doesn't happen once. It doesn't happen occasionally. It goes on systematically throughout the time that they're targeting a particular enterprise.
Well, nobody disputes that. I'm glad to hear Ms. Strand echoing the fact that this is a law that calls behavior which is aimed at economic harm, and certainly people can debate the merits or the ethics of trying to shut down businesses, which are often demonstrably cruel and which undercover videos by investigators have shown to engage in extremely cruel practices. Let me finish, please. Can debate the merits and ethics of that, but to call that terrorism is utterly beyond the pale and excessive. It's new under the law. It does a gross disservice to all of us, and there are already laws that inculpate all of these behaviors. I mean, the simple fact is that documents which have been uncovered in Freedom of Information Act requests show that the FBI does treat and consider conduct as de minimis as videotaping abuses of animals to be chargeable under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, or was technically the predecessor to the law, the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which was even less restrictive than this one. So there's a real harm. And to the point that this doesn't involve the vandalism of teenagers going out, on a sort of night's spree. Interestingly, in a relatively recent case involving a bunch of teenagers who clubbed chickens to death, I think on a foster farm, those kids are not being charged with terrorism. They killed animals, and they did massive economic damage to that venture. The people who are charged with terrorism are the people who are liberating animals and threaten no harm. So people can have a lot of different views and opinions about animal rights and animal welfare and what's happening to these animals. But in fact, this law is designed to target people who themselves are trying to expose undercover and, in many cases, liberate and save animals who are being abused.
But Ben Rosenfeld, you've represented people in this situation. If this law were not on the book, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, what's the limit of what they could be charged with?
Well, they can be charged with any number of longstanding crimes for vandalism, trespass, theft. If those crimes rise to the level of some sort of violence or intimidation, then obviously there's a whole suite of laws that can be used to charge people with personal crimes.
So in this case, we're talking about over $100,000 of property destruction, according to the attorney's office who's charging the case. So what would be the maximum sentence that federal prosecutors could pursue if they didn't have these terrorism charges available to them?
There's no stock answer to that question because, first of all, most of these would be state law crimes that would be charged in local jurisdictions, and those penalties vary by state and they vary by region. But it's safe to say that those penalties are perfectly stiff. But as you pointed out, they're not penalties for rape and murder, and you very easily can be charged and convicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and sentenced. For economic damage, by the way, which is measured as loss of profits to industry and can include things as remote as the cost that they incur to beef up security if, for example, they're concerned about trespassing. It doesn't even really have to be a good showing that their economic expenditures result from any particular crime. I mean, it's the accounting method is so nebulous as to quickly scale up these penalties to the point where you can do 20 years under this act if you're accused of causing economic damage in excess of $1 million, even if you haven't even remotely done anything violent or threatened a person. And how that money gets tabulated again. I mean, you look, for example, at the documentary on Blackfish on SeaWorld's use of killer whales.
Yeah.
I mean, there the company incurred arguably $1 billion in losses. The people who did that video with the intention of hurting SeaWorld economically could be threatened under this law with incarceration of 20 years.
Patty Strand, let me redirect this to you because, you walked through some... horrifying cases where people were threatened or had their windows shot out or whatever. But if you isolate a case where the only allegation is property destruction, vandalism, there's not even allegation of a threat of violence or intimidation, do you think it should be charged that harshly, that this should put someone away for 10 years?
The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act specifically says the statute covers any act that either damages...
Well, I'm not asking what the law says. I'm asking what you think is right.
We lobbied in favor of this. I still believe that it is appropriate. I think what the public doesn't understand is that with the animal rights movement, with a certain wing within the animal rights movement, you have an ends justifies the means sort of operation going on, which will really stop at nothing. A minute ago, the attorney that you have there talked about, we have demonstrated that there's cruelty going on. Well, cruelty is in the eyes of the beholder. And by the way, we champion all kinds of cruelty laws, too. We do not want to see people abusing animals. But under their definition, anyone who disagrees with how an animal should be used could be subject to the kind of targeting that they do.
So which cruelty laws have you championed? Where do you draw the line?
Pardon me?
Which cruelty laws have you championed? Where do you draw the line?
Oh, we've championed cruelty laws all over the country. Certainly, we don't want people to...
Can you give us an example?
Taking this off target, what you're trying to do is imply that if I don't agree with you, that I'm somehow in favor of cruelty. And I'm not, and our organization is not, and most of the people we work with are the very people who have spent their lives developing animal welfare standards within industries.
Sorry, Patty Strand, you said you've sponsored animal cruelty laws to establish your bona fides. I'm just asking for an example.
But there is a big difference between animal welfare, which our group believes in, that animals can and should be used so long as they are used humanely and responsibly, and animal rights, which the animal liberationists believe in. Let me finish, please. That does not believe that animals should be used for any purpose, no matter how humane or how responsible. And then comes forward, and by the way, just because, you know, you're talking about this in some kind of idealistic way that makes these people sound wonderful, simply because I wrote an article in the early 90s, I began to get death threats at my house. We had threats coming to our son, who was in school at that time. When we've had conferences on this subject, we've had people show up and threaten people. We've had our house, pictures of our house put on the internet and watched and told people when my husband goes to work and when he's home. So these are not just nice, warm, and fuzzy people who just care about animals. They are systematically aimed at trying to eliminate whole industries and shut down the opinions of people who disagree with them.
Okay, so Ms. Strand, can I get a word in?
Hold on. So I'm going to ask you both not to talk over each other. Please wrap up, Patty Strand.
I'm done.
Okay. I'm sorry about that. Hold on, Ben. I'll get back to you. And Patty Strand, I just wanted to clarify for our listeners, the business that you're involved in, you're a dog breeder. You're not running an animal laboratory or for a farm yourself.
I'm a hobby dog breeder, and in my life, maybe once a year, maybe twice a year, very, very occasionally, in 46 years, I might have a litter. I've worked with animal control agencies and other kinds of animal welfare organizations to help them implement laws and so on. So, again, the very definition of somebody who should be targeted by these people is just simply people who disagree with them.
Well, right. you're lumping all these people in homogeneously. I mean, there's a very big range of attitudes and behaviors, and I mean, simply to suggest that everybody who has an attitude in favor of animal protection is some kind of animal rights extremist is really fallacious.
Ben Rosenfeld, let's hone in on one of the examples she raised. So she talked about getting death threats. If you don't have the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act at your disposal as a prosecutor, what tools does the prosecution have to charge that?
Obviously, we all know that they have immense tools. I mean, people are charged with making death threats every day in this country and every state. We don't need a law that brands as terrorism making a threat, a law which is completely novel, which is without precedent and without equal under the entire system of federal laws that calls behavior which does not involve actual murder or injury terrorism, laws which criminalize and subject people to incredibly harsh draconian penalties based on nothing but nebulous measures of economic damage, behavior which involves petty acts of theft, vandalism, under currently existing laws, and that at their heart have the goal of saving life, liberating life, not injuring life.
Patty Smith, is it fair to say that you think there need to be these special protections, these terrorism statutes for the animal industry because animal rights activists are more organized than people who might target other types of businesses?
Well, to the lawyer's point, we do not think that everyone in the animal, we consider ourselves part of the animal protection movement. Okay, number one, it is just a wing within the animal rights movement. They're called animal liberationists that engage in these kinds of activities, although there is a continuum all the way from people who maybe videotape and then edit the videotape so that it shows what they would like the public to see, to people who actually light the firebombs and so on. So
You just jumped from taking video to lighting firebombs. I mean, do you think that people should be charged as terrorists for taking videos? And also, can we at least all agree on this conference?
I didn't say that, sir. I said there was a continuum.
Okay, but can we agree?
I really want to ask this point.
I know you do, but
I'm trying to referee here. I do want to give her the room to finish her sentences. So I will come back to you, I promise. Go ahead, Patty Smith. Sorry, Patty Strand.
My point is that there is a continuum of interest and beliefs within the animal rights, animal protection movement. Our organization and the people we represent believe that it is appropriate to use animals so long as they are used humanely and responsibly. And we think that we are lined up with the American public, because about 97% of the public eat meat and therefore, at least at some level, agree that animals, that it is appropriate for people to be able to utilize animals so long as they do so responsibly. There is no question that there is also abuse of animals, and it wouldn't matter whether we're talking about animals or whether we're talking about any other kind of pursuit. There will always be some people who refuse to do it right, who are going to operate outside the law and so on. We are not supporting those kinds of people. We are supporting people who are doing legal activities and who are, as a result of their disagreement with the animal rights extremists within the animal protection movement, targeted for intimidation and actual terrorism.
Well, here's what I want to ask. Your organization, the National Animal Interest Alliance, and you have just said that you support laws which make it a crime to engage in animal cruelty, and you position yourselves as an animal welfare organization. You've just said that. Can you agree that housing mink in tiny wire cages for their entire miserable lives is animal cruelty? I mean, as a welfare organization, are you going to take a stand against keeping mink in those kinds of conditions? I mean, let's talk about what's relevant here.
I would say that we would take a stand against people who, because they disagree with that, firebomb buildings.
That's not what I asked.
Wire cutters to release them. We would want people who disagree to operate in a lawful way.
That's not at all what I asked. You said you're a welfare organization.
That they would bring that to the public in such a way that they could change the law.
You're clearly evading the question.
I'm sorry.
Forward, honestly,
Patty Strand, do you have any position? Your organization have any position on mink farming practices?
We are in favor of people in agriculture, whether for fiber or for food, so long as they are operating under the existing laws.
This is not for food. This is for fur.
And we would work to improve laws where deficits are shown.
But do you have any position?
We don't have any laws that regulate mink farming to that extent that prevent them from being kept in these kinds of conditions.
With the fur issues, I happen to live in a city where the second oldest fur store in the United States existed, and from protesting in front of the store and breaking windows and gluing locks nonstop for a number of years, it went out of business. And so my involvement in terms of this particular issue, I'm not a very knowledgeable person as far as how these animals are raised. I do know that in the information that was brought forward or presented to the public from the activists, that there was a fair amount of misrepresentation. There were images of mink being electrocuted in ways that are against the law and in ways that the people that I had worked with would never have supported. So I think we'd have to cut through all of the propaganda and find out what's really going on before I could make
a comment. I'm not talking about propaganda, I'm talking about an unassailable fact that mink are kept in these miserable conditions. I'm not talking about just the way they die, which is problematic enough. I'm talking about the way they live.
If a
self-styled animal welfare advocate can't agree that this is a cruel and inhumane practice, and your website uses the word inhumane and says that you're opposed to inhumane treatment of animals, if we can't agree on that, we have no commonality. Other people listening to us will have to make up their minds what they think about that question. But what we should be able to agree is that liberating animals from those conditions, whatever you want to call it, is not terrorism.
All right, Ben Rosenfeld, Patty Strand, we have burned through all the time that we have available to us for the segment. I want to thank you both. I am sorry that the conversation fell apart at the end. The last voice you heard was that of Ben Rosenfeld, an attorney who has defended several animal rights activists charged under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, also on the advisory board of the Civil Liberties Defense Center. On the telephone, we have Patty Strand, president of the National Animal Interest Alliance, which lobbied for the passage of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. It's being used to charge Joseph Buddenberg and Nicole Kissane, two Oakland-based animal rights activists, with conspiracy to violate the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, for which they face up to 10 years in prison and $250,000 in fines for acts of vandalism that did not include any violence, threats of violence, or intimidation, as far as we know from the charges that the federal attorneys have unveiled. It is 7:30 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. We're going to stay on the law and order theme and look at the new framework under which local sheriff's departments are now being asked to work with federal immigration authorities. We will talk to Alameda County Sheriff Greg Ahern, who is leading one of the departments that used to not work with federal immigration but now does under the new framework. Then we'll talk to an immigrant rights attorney who thinks that's a bad idea. That's all after these news headlines with Eileen Alfandari.
Top administration officials are on Capitol Hill again today to try to convince lawmakers to support the Iran nuclear deal. Defense Secretary Ash Carter told members of the Senate Armed Services Committee the deal places no limitations on U.S. military activity in the region.
If Iran were to commit aggression, our robust force posture ensures we can rapidly surge an overwhelming array of forces into the region, leveraging our most advanced capabilities, married with sophisticated munitions that put no target out of reach.
Congress has begun a 60-day review of the international agreement with a vote expected in September. The Senate Armed Services Committee is led by Republican John McCain, a key opponent of the Iran nuclear deal. Opponents of California's new vaccine law have been cleared to begin collecting signatures to recall the legislation's author. The California Secretary of State said advocates can begin collecting signatures in Sacramento and Yolo counties for the recall of State Senator Richard Pan. The Sacramento Democrat and pediatrician led the drive this year to make vaccinations mandatory for nearly all California school children. A separate statewide ballot initiative that would invalidate the law also has been cleared to collect signatures. The Los Angeles City Council has voted to ban possession of high-capacity gun magazines in the wake of several deadly mass shootings around the country. L.A. becomes the second major city with such a law after San Francisco. The unanimous Los Angeles vote closes a loophole in state law that banned the manufacture and sale of clips holding more than 10 rounds, but not their possession. Texas authorities have released additional footage from Sandra Bland's 3 days in jail, saying they want to dispel rumors she was dead before she got there. Waller County Judge Trey Duhon said reports circulating on social media, including one that Bland's mugshot was taken after her death, have prompted death threats against county officials. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area. Sunny, hot, breezy in the afternoon. Highs in the 80s to lower 90s around the bay. 104 degrees well inland. It is another spare the air day. In Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot. Highs 101 to 106 degrees. You can follow us on Twitter at KPFA News. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 8 a.m.
7:33 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. And we're still starting to see the political fallout from the Kate Steinle killing in San Francisco. This is the young woman who was allegedly murdered by a man who had been held on immigration charges. And then after he was returned by immigration authorities to the San Francisco Sheriff's Office, was released, came across a gun and pulled the trigger while it was pointed at her. Now, many, many counties in California had taken advantage of a law called the Trust Act that gives them the option of not cooperating with federal immigration authorities. And there's been an argument for this in community policing that particularly if you're a law enforcement official who has a large immigrant population in the area you serve, it's more important for people to feel comfortable coming to you reporting crime than for you to help federal authorities deport people for a civil offense like overstaying a visa. The rebuttal to that from the right has been that some immigrants are dangerous and get to stay in this country as a result of that program. Well, the federal government, partly as a result of the Deferred Action Program, which takes a lighter stance towards immigrants who've been here since their childhoods, has rejiggered their program for cooperating with local law enforcement. It used to be called Secure Communities. Now it's called the Priority Enforcement Program. And one of the counties that has made a reversal from not working with Secure Communities to working with Priorities Enforcement is Alameda County. The Sheriff, Gregory Ahern, is good enough to join us on the phone right now. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
When did you decide to sign Alameda County up for Priority Enforcement Program?
Well, you phrased our immigration issue very well, but we've been dealing with this since Secure Communities came into effect in about 2008. And we've been arguing that there is not a consistent program for local, state, and federal agencies to enforce in our various counties, state, and country. So we've asked for the federal government and ICE to come up with a program that was consistent for all of our citizens so everybody could be treated equally in all parts of the land. And so we discussed these issues. Recently we had a meeting with the Homeland Security Director, Jay Johnson, who actually came into the city of Oakland and expressed his interest in us cooperating with them with the Priority Enforcement Program. So we began that program in July of this year.
Was it specifically a reaction to the Kate Steinle killing?
No. Brian, we've been working on this since a long time. The different stages of immigration have come with from Secure Communities to the Trust Act to a federal case in Oregon in Clackamas County indicated ICE detainers, if an individual was held after their release time, would be a violation of their Fourth Amendment right. And so we've been adjusting our policies and practices to be in compliance with state and federal law. So,
but you chose not to work with the Secure Communities program. What is different about Priority Enforcement?
Priority Enforcement has a mandate that the immigration people must follow in regards to the individuals under six categories. And Secure Communities identified people, all individuals arrested that were taken into custody. This program focuses more on people under six categories that include wanted for terrorism, who participated in organized criminal gangs, have been convicted of a felony, that have been convicted of aggravated felonies. They are also a category for significant misdemeanors. And the final category is three or more misdemeanors, not including minor traffic offenses. So the PEP program identifies individuals that have been arrested a number of times, convicted of serious felonies.
But couldn't that be a nonviolent drug offender? I mean, someone with a habit, not someone who's any violent risk?
Well, no longer in California. Those would be considered misdemeanors under Prop 47 if you're under the influence or in possession of a small amount.
Yeah, you said three or more misdemeanor convictions.
Yes. So if they were convicted of three or more offenses, that would mean that an individual who's suspected of being in the country illegally not only was arrested once, twice, but three times, and not just arrested three times, but convicted on those three times while in the country illegally.
Couldn't a misdemeanor also be driving without a license?
No, they don't include the minor traffic offenses.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
And one more time, these individuals aren't automatically deported. They're processed through an administrative hearing with the immigration hearing. So it's just these people would be identified as individuals that would be taken in front of that process.
So I guess the bigger issue here and the global concern that immigrants' rights activist has raised is local law enforcement becoming an arm of federal immigration authorities. You're in the business of enforcing crimes that happen within your jurisdiction. Why would you want to be in the business of handing off people who've overstayed their visas?
Well, a couple of things. One, we do not go out and make immigration arrests. That's not our job. That's not our focus. There's other people that do that. Our focus is simply cooperating with immigration, customs enforcement under these six categories.
But you pick people up on smaller crimes. Once you run them through your system under PEP, you have to report them to federal immigration authorities, and you'll hold them if they ask for it, right?
Well, we don't report them to immigration. Immigration reports them to us because we don't have access to the databases as the immigration people would.
Right, but you send in the data of everyone you arrest.
We have the person in custody, and it's the obligation of the ICE officer to find out if individuals in our custody fall under one of these six categories. We don't assist them in doing that.
Are you saying you don't report any information on the people you arrest to Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
No, we don't have like a direct report policy for them. The officers come in and do their work. We allow them an opportunity to review our databases just like we do all of our other federal partners that we work with.
So what about the trust issue? In other words, if you are seeing the Alameda County Sheriff's Office as a path to deportation, aren't you concerned that might make someone who's undocumented or has someone undocumented in their family more reluctant to, say, call in a domestic violence incident?
You bring up a very valid point that we've been discussing for a number of years, and yes, we are concerned, and we do take steps to build the trust in our community dealing with those individuals, specifically Hispanic people born in Mexico. We have community policing units that go out and assure them on a regular basis that we're not the enforcement branch of immigration, that we're here to respond to their issues, and they are free to call us in regards to their safety, in regards to small traffic-related matters, up to domestic violence, to drug issues. We work with those community groups in a number of different ways.
But how do you do that if getting picked up by your office is it could potential path toward deportation?
Well, we're dealing with what I believe are two different groups. One group that are involved in criminal activity, another group that's involved in community activities. So we focus on the people involved in community activities and try to build up the trust in those neighborhoods and with those individuals. And then we do cooperate with the individuals that are violating the laws and are members of street gangs and commit violent crime in our area.
So where is the line for you, Sheriff Ahern? What level of cooperation with federal immigration authorities would be too much? What would compromise your relationship to the communities you serve?
Well, we believe that we're going to comply with the PEP program. We think that is a fair balance. We still ask the federal government for immigration reform on a national level so that everybody's following underneath the same guidelines, the same rules in all jurisdictions. So we don't follow, we don't believe that the Trust Act is applicable because the Trust Act allows us to honor detainers and keep people in custody for 48 hours, and my agency does not do that. My agency only does not honor any detainers. We only honor the things that have judicial review or a complaint has been filed and reviewed by a judge and a warrant has been issued. Other than that, the immigration people are obligated to do their own work, do their own job, and do their own enforcement. We don't do immigration enforcement.
Right. So if you pick someone up and ultimately the DA decide not to charge them, and immigration said hold on to them, you would not hold them past the point where you would release them anyway.
Exactly. We believe that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment that was resolved in the Clackamas County case in Oregon.
But, and I think this is what the concern is, because you're giving Immigration and Customs Enforcement access to the databases and everyone you pick up, they'll know when that person is scheduled for release and could be waiting right at the door.
That's correct.
To an outsider, to someone who's not in your department, that could be a distinction without a difference. It's still a seamless transition from Santa Rita Jail to a nice deportation facility.
Well, that is the possibility if the individuals end up getting arrested and like I'm telling you, this is not a perfect program. It's just something that we've come up with that we feel is fair and balanced, and that we're working with the different groups to make sure this program stays fair to everybody that comes into our custody.
All right. Sheriff Ahern, I want to thank you very much for your time this morning.
All right. Now, I really do appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Gregory Ahern is the sheriff of Alameda County. Alameda County, one of the counties in California that under the California Trust Act chose not to work with federal immigration authorities under the Secure Communities Program, which had local police departments hold people on immigration detainer requests, but has... Now, Alameda County made this decision in July, although they say it had nothing to do with the Kate Steinle killing and the political backlash that resulted from it. Alameda County now has chosen to work with a new version of that program called the PEP program, Priorities Enforcement Program. We're joined now on the phone by one of the critics of that program. Grisel Ruiz is a staff attorney for the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Thanks for joining us.
Morning. How are you? Thank you.
I'm well. You heard our conversation with Sheriff Ahern. How much of a difference do you think there is between PEP and Secure Communities?
Sure. So at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, we actually come at this work with years of experience in this area. We've been working on these issues locally at the state level and at the federal level, often in tandem with stakeholders such as local immigrant groups, but also even DAs and even local law enforcement agencies. So we come at this with a lot of experience. And I think it's important to note that we all want the same thing, in the sense that we all want community safety. We all want our streets to be safe. We all want to feel safe in our own homes. The problem is that the priority enforcement program and then the other program that would enhance cooperation between local law enforcement and ICE doesn't do that. It actually makes communities less safe, is what we've seen, by decreasing community trust. So looking at PEP specifically, it's been touted as this new and improved program, but we have no evidence to suggest that it is. We actually know very little about it, but from what we have seen, we've seen that it has the same failings as its predecessor, as the ESCOM program. It continues to target an overly broad category of people and still carries a lot of the same unconstitutional practices as the past.
Well, like, can you point to a specific example of someone who's been detained and deported under PEP who you think would be better off if they hadn't been?
Yeah, sure. So PEP does continue to target a large swath of people. It includes certain misdemeanors, including certain significant misdemeanors, but that still covers a broad category of people. So, for example, you could have someone with a DUI conviction. You could have somebody with multiple nonviolent possessions, for example, that may have happened 10, 20 years ago, where the person is totally rehabilitated. The individual is living a productive life with their family, but that individual could still be and will still be targeted under this program and will still be targeted aggressively under this program. And what's even more troubling is that once that individual is in the immigration system, once they're in the deportation system, and I used to be a deportation defense attorney, they're suddenly subsumed into a system with very little due process. They could be detained. They could be detained states away. They may not have an attorney. They may not even get a fair day in court. So it's also, we're also seeing this coupling with between the federal government and a federal government immigration system that's had very little transparency and very little due process.
So I want to like hone in on the first example you raised, which is a driving under the influence conviction. Surely some people would argue that this is a dangerous activity, and that if you're in this country without papers and you get nailed for driving under the influence, you should be deported. You put other people's lives at risk by doing that.
You know, we are a country of second chances, and people do make mistakes. And we do have a criminal justice system to hold people accountable for those mistakes. And that's a system that, in theory, that should be treating people equally regardless of their immigration status. The problem with these programs is it's subjecting immigrants to a second tier of punishment for the same activity. So you have somebody who makes a mistake, pays for that mistake to the criminal justice system, does their time or does whatever else is required of them from the criminal justice system, and then is subjected to an additional punishment, deportation, which is often going to be even worse because that's essentially banishment from this country, which for certain people, that could be people who've spent their entire lives here and actually have very strong ties, essentially resulting in countless torn families here in the U.S.
So, Grisel Ruiz, I want to shift to kind of the political lay of the land. This became a national issue after the killing in San Francisco that I referred to earlier. Have you seen a wave of California jurisdictions suddenly signing on to the federal PEP program since then?
So, the federal PEP program was announced late last year, and its portions of it have come into effect this year, and we're actually just seeing PEP roll out in the rest of its aspects now. So we know that DHS, that the federal government, has been reaching out to several localities to get them to sign on. What we think is very important is for all of these localities that are considering PEP, that they remember what we've been learning for years, that in a state like California, especially, and anywhere really, but especially in a state in California, the most immigrant-rich state in the country, you cannot pass public safety policies without considering the immigrant community. And as we've seen, the immigrant community will not feel safe reporting crimes or acting as witnesses if they know that doing so could result in their deportation. And in the past, it has. And especially here in the Bay Area, where we're so diverse and all of our communities are so integrated, it's really critical for people to feel safe reporting crime. And you want your neighbor to feel safe reporting crime, not only for their safety, but for yours as well. And under these policies and under PEP, they won't.
So what's your take on what the Alameda County Sheriff's Department has done? They stayed away from secure communities, then signed on to PEP. You've worked with them. What do you think?
You know, for any community, for any locality that would sign on to PEP, that's something that our organization, and I think any organization that's intimately familiar, that has years of experience working with the immigrant community and working on public safety issues, would be opposed to any partnership under PEP. Again, you know, the PEP program has been touted as this new and improved program, but we've heard that from DHS in the past. We've heard promises of new programs that redirect their resources, new memos that shift priorities. And on the ground, we see that exactly the same thing happens. People are targeted en masse. People are targeted with little discretion. People funneled into the deportation system where they're really set up to fail. So we would be opposed to any partnership. And part of what I do at the ILRC is I go out into the community and inform them of their rights. If I know in a given community that contact with the criminal justice system could result in that individual's deportation, I cannot in good faith tell somebody that they can trust local law enforcement. I want to, but I think to achieve that, you really need true division between federal agencies and immigration and local law enforcement. And federal immigration is the federal government's job. They're extremely well funded for this. They have more funding for immigration enforcement than any other federal agency combined. They should use that funding to do their job and allow local law enforcement agencies to do theirs, which is to focus on cooperating with the community.
Grisel Ruiz, I just kind of want to clarify where you come down on this. Do you think there is any crime which, if there is a conviction, should lead to deportation above and beyond whatever the sentence for that crime is?
Sure. So I think that this SF tragedy, and it really is awful what happened, and our heart goes out and our, you know, thoughts go out to the family. But what's made this case really difficult is it's really politicized the issue. And the actions of one individual should not be used to stereotype and scapegoat an entire immigrant community. We just cannot. We cannot engage in reactionary politics. And the thing is that immigrants actually do not violate greater the criminal laws at greater rates than U.S. citizens. In fact, we have a recent study that shows that they violate at lower rates. So when we create policies in our criminal justice system that target immigrants alone, it really perpetuates harmful stereotypes. And it actually decreases community trust and public safety overall. And then going more specifically to your question, the problem is that we have a deportation system that doesn't even fully allow judges to consider all of the equities in a case. So in any case, you want a judge to be able to balance, you know, the individual's equities with whatever other criminal history may be. And their hands are so tied right now to do that equitably, to do that fairly, that it's really not okay to funnel people into that system under any circumstances.
All right. Grisel Ruiz, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure.
Grisel Ruiz is a staff attorney at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. That takes us to 7:54 in the morning. The program is Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert, and you're listening to KPFA 94.1 FM. We'll be right back. And before we take you out this morning, a quick look at what's happening on the stage. Our own Richard Walensky has this review of Company, currently playing at the San Francisco Playhouse through September 12th.
The entire story of Stephen Sondheim and George Firth's Company, playing at San Francisco Playhouse through September 12th, takes place in a few seconds in the mind of the lead character, Bobby, as he contemplates his upcoming 35th birthday party, his married friends, and his own lack of a committed relationship. Back in 1970, when the show premiered on Broadway, nobody had ever seen anything like it. There's really no story, no plot, just that contemplation of marriage and relationships set in a vibrant, to-the-moment, contemporary New York City. The show created a new genre, the concept musical. The fact that musicals these days can revolve around pretty much anything and can go anywhere is most likely due to this particular show's success. It loosened the standards for what a musical can do and say. In addition, Company marked the first of eight musicals that would establish Stephen Sondheim as the preeminent musical theater composer-lyricist of the last half of the 20th century. While many have tried, nobody has quite matched the brilliance and combined intricacy of Sondheim's words and melodies, and Company shows him at the top of his game. Each song is a gem. But it's a difficult show to pull off because of that intricacy. However, this San Francisco production has done itself proud. Leading the way in the difficult role of Bobby is Keith Pinto, who nails it, particularly during the final solo, Being Alive, along with Stephanie Prentice as Joanne, Elaine Stritch's signature role in the original, who puts her own stamp on Ladies of Lunch, and SF Playhouse stalwart Monique Hafen, whose tour de force performance of Not Getting Married stops the show. Susie Damilano's direction stands out, as does the choreography by Kimberly Richards, performed beautifully by the entire cast. The song and dance opening the second act, Side by Side by Side, is a knockout. Kudos also to the set design by Bill English and Jacqueline Scott. Now the downside. In 2006, for a Broadway revival, one song was added, Marry Me a Little, all to the good, but some lines were changed to update the show, along with the use of cell phones. That's a problem, because the attitudes in Company toward marriage, relationships, aging, and recreational drugs keep the show firmly set as a 70s period piece, and the revisions come out as jarring. Hopefully, Sondheim will abandon them for future productions, but we shall see. In the meantime, Company is still a great show, and for fans of Broadway musicals, this production is a must-see. Company plays at SF Playhouse in San Francisco through September 12th. For more information, you can go to their website, sfplayhouse.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Bay Area Theater for Upfront.
And in addition to hearing his reviews here, you can hear Richard Walensky's feature-length interviews during Cover to Cover, particularly on Thursdays, which we air at 3 o'clock. That does it for today's show. Upfront is a production of the KPFA News Department. We're here weekday mornings at 7 a.m. If you've got feedback on anything you heard or want to suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org or hit us on the Twitter at UpfrontKPFA. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Eileen Alfandari is our executive producer and our news editor. Linda Khoury is our interim producer. Sophie Becker is our production intern. Kirsten Thomas is at the controls. And my name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. Stay tuned for Uprising with Sonali Kulhucker coming up at 8 a.m.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Dennis Bernstein, host of Flashpoints here on KPFA. Just in case you haven't noticed, I'd like to point out that you haven't heard me asking for your support this summer. We promised you that we would try to cut down on pledge drives this year, and now we're delivering on that promise. No summer fun drive. We know how fatigued you are with being asked to donate so often. And we also realize we're taking a chance, like walking a high wire without a net, to deliver on the bargain we've made. You've done your part. You've been patient with us and very generous, and we owe you this fun drive free summer. We couldn't have done it without you. So enjoy the summer, and we'll be back in the fall with a tremendous fun drive of great new thank you gifts and information you can only get at 94.1 FM. For you listeners who appreciate our efforts to reduce the fun drive days and are able to